I will touch on some of the controversy now. So you can already see that, like, yeah, this guy's hanging out with children a lot. He seems to like being around them a lot. Seemed particularly friendly with these three littles. Somewhere in the between 1863 and 1865, maybe, I think it might have just been the year 1863, his journals, like his diary, they have all of these, right? But there's like a year where all of the pages have been removed. Welcome, friends, to episode 309 of the Ink to Film podcast, where we read the book and then see the movie. I'm writer Luke Elliott.
And I'm filmmaker James Bailey.
And this week we discuss Lewis Carroll's 1865 and 1871 novels, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. All right, James, you ready to go down the rabbit hole? Follow the white rabbit all the way down? This is one of the most quoted, referenced pieces of work in all of literature. I heard behind Shakespeare and the Bible are like the only two things above Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, it's so universal. I like to immerse myself in as much as I can of a project when we're covering it. So like, I'm listening to Jefferson Airplane talk, you know, the song White Rabbit. I'm all over the spectrum. I'm like consuming some videos about it here and there on YouTube. Yeah. And it's such an all-encompassing one in a really sneaky way, I guess, for me. Like it feels like a story that everybody knows, but I don't hear people talking about it all that often. Maybe that has to do with its age, but yeah. Unbelievably referenced, like just off the top of my head, a lot of fantasy stuff, like Jabberwocky, Vorpal swords, and like all these different things that exist in this world are then brought into other worlds.
Yeah, the Matrix. I mean, the list goes on and on, and just the number of references, and things that we don't even like recognize. Like I led off with going down the rabbit hole. That is a thing that people say now all the time. Oh, I went down the rabbit hole on this topic. You know, like it just means to go, like, you went in there. There was like unexpected depth and you kind of got lost in it. Right. Mm-hmm. It's just a common phrase now that I don't even think people realize it is literally referencing this. It is referencing following the rabbit down the rabbit hole of Alice, and, you know, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which is the technical title of this first book. It's amazing. And I think it's also one of those most influential pieces that generations of writers grew up reading these books. That influences everything, right? Like James Joyce and like I just saw the like huge list, like Virginia Woolf. You have Salvador Dali did all these paintings based off of Alice in Wonderland. Like there's just so many different artists were influenced by it, and then so that continues to perpetuate and like extend its reach, which is really quite staggering and hard to put into words just how big this one is.
Yeah, and I think the characters stand out as really like you think of the Cheshire Cat and the Red Queen and
the Mad Hatter.
Mad Hatter. And then the ways that I'm sure we're going to talk about this, but the ways that it's definitely also been picked up by, or at least it was in like the 60s drug culture, right? And this idea of like it feels like a dream. This whole story feels like a dream or a fever dream or an acid trip or you know, a drug quest that you've gone on here.
I think I want to, if it's cool with you, I think we should honestly hold that for next week when we do the Disney adaptation. I'm not sure how much of it is tied to that particular adaptation, but that is a pretty modern look at this, whereas for the longest time that wasn't the case. I think it really came with like drug culture in the 60s and 70s. I think really tapped into that reading of it. From all accounts, it really doesn't seem like that was the case. It really didn't have anything to do with drugs or mind-altering substances of any kind. It was supposed to be surreal, but in a more, I don't know, innocent sense, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with holding it to next week. It's definitely, it's a big topic. But
that's definitely a part of its legacy. I totally agree.
I was going to say, it's a part of its legacy for me. Like the way I approach it and think about it is so painted by that in some ways. But yeah, I mean, let's just talk about it as a dream, because it absolutely feels that way. I said fever dream. Like it's going from kind of setup to plot point to it's traveling in such a fluid way through the narrative. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, it takes you on a wild ride. And as an adult looking at, as a kid, I feel like you're just, I don't know, you haven't experienced as many stories and you're just along for this wild ride. As an adult looking at it, I'm like, how do you even formulate a story like this? Because it is so almost like stream of consciousness. Like, what if this crazy thing, random thing happened next?
Well, I have some stories about that. we will get into a lot of the stories and legends around the creation of this, and then a lot of the controversies that surround Lewis Carroll. And we'll talk about the way it divides scholars to this day. But before we get into all of that, because I don't want to like start coloring anything, I just want to like, what was your experience like reading this, and what was your history with the material before covering it for this podcast? Like, had you actually read either of these books?
I don't think I had. Definitely very familiar with the Disney film. Alice in Wonderland is one of the first levels that you play in Kingdom Hearts. So just like running around as Sora, playing in those worlds and, you know, taking different things that are making you bigger and smaller and like really living that narrative in an interesting way that I don't think either film or books can deliver. I feel very like intimately aware of like the setup and the surroundings of Alice in Wonderland because of that. But yeah, I mean, I watched the film, I mean, I can't countless times. Like we've been talking about, it kind of is one of those projects that it's sneakily such a big part of culture. Like in terms of, you know, Down the Rabbit Hole is a great example, but there's so many of those. And we mentioned references before. This book is referencing nursery rhymes and other things, or I guess like Through the Looking Glass technically does it more, but it's referencing poems, it seems like, that you know, I probably haven't read. Humpty
Dumpty shows up, which was an established like nursery rhyme kind of deal. Yeah, he's actually referencing a ton of stuff in both of these books, which we'll get into some of it. I won't be able to cover all of it, but a lot of the stuff that appears in here were actually like in jokes that like you kind of had to be from that area to even know what the hell he was referencing. Or know the certain people that he knew and things like that.
Yeah, so like piggybacking on like Humpty Dumpty and telling sort of an alternative version of that story feels fresh even now, because it's like those universal stories that everyone knows, and Alice in Wonderland has become one of those, but everyone has heard Humpty Dumpty growing up, and
I definitely I grew up on that.
I feel like that was in like a Tweedledum.
Yeah, now I think he did invent that, but it's a reference to like an epigram from a poet or something, so he didn't invent the names, but like the characters that we know are from Through the Looking Glass. But Humpty Dumpty was one that was pre-existing, as far as I can tell. It's really fascinating because, like, you know, originating stuff versus, like, popularizing is something we often talk about. And, like, a lot of this stuff is definitely, like, popular because it appeared in these books. For me, like, I'd always felt like I was on the periphery of Alice in Wonderland. I had seen the Disney film, and that was, I think, my only real exposure to it. And then in like high school, we read some of the poetry that appear in these books. He had published them elsewhere sometimes, or they had appeared elsewhere. So it wasn't like the Jabberwocky he had written like 16 years before.
And even without reading Through the Looking Glass, I had heard the Jabberwocky poem, or whatever you would call that sort of rhyming.
Well, because it's probably the most famous version of a nonsense poem ever written.
Okay.
And in general, Lewis Carroll is famous for popularizing and maybe even creating the nonsense fiction genre, which Alice in Wonderland is considered. And you're talking a little bit about that, like dreamlike, like stuff doesn't make a lot of sense. It's considered a nonsense writing. But it's funny because the more I looked into it, the more it was like, actually a lot of this stuff that seems like it makes no sense actually kind of does. It's just in like a playful way, trying to be absurd. Like it's playing with absurdist ideas and absurdism. The man was really smart. He was a mathematician. He was a professor at Oxford. He taught geometry and logic, and he was a very buttoned down, like rigorous, like everything had rules kind of person. And then to write this book where it was all about like the ways that can be fall apart and be challenged, and a world where logic doesn't follow, right? And where things are in reverse, or things are mirror images, or things play out backwards. I think part of the appeal of this was that like breaking the rules, he connected that with being a child and how like before you learn all this stuff, like you're more free to imagine and to live in a world that is free of rules in a sense. So for me, like reading this, I know for a fact it was my first time reading Through the Looking Glass. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland may have been read to me or portions of it, but so long ago, I barely remember. But it was more familiar for sure. But maybe it's just because I'm more familiar with a lot of what goes on. I don't know. But regardless, like I found it to be like, I'm kind of two minds of it. Like on one hand, I found myself a little like adrift in the narrative as we're just like going from thing to thing. Nothing feels resolved. Like we'd set up something and then just abandon it. We'd meet some characters and then we'd just leave them behind. And it was always just kind of on to the next thing. But like abstractly, that feels very dreamlike to me. And in a way that like it feels appropriate for children, because when I think back to like I used to tell stories to my friends growing up. And I think a lot of those stories, if you were to go back and like see what I was actually saying, I'm sure it was a lot of just like from one thing to the next thing. No connective tissue, really. Just like just transition. You know, no narrative arc to it. And that's kind of how this feels at times. It feels like we're just wandering through and kind of having this adventure log, and things we're encountering are just bizarre. And so I was sort of enthralled at the same time as I was a bit put off by the bizarre wandering nature of, like, I wanted it to make more sense and to like follow in some way. I think a part of me wanted that looks for meaning in stories and wants to like track what's going on. It became very difficult to track what was going on and like what it, you know, I've seen it written out in ways where I feel like I kind of understand it more now, but my first experience just passing through it, I felt a bit lost at times. Did you have any of that?
A little bit, yeah, but I think I was engaging with it in the way that it was meant to be, sort of, you know, like a dream, in the sense that like you're like, it's hard to grasp onto things and really understand where or why. There's no reason. And you're talking about like the idea of this being for kids or speaking to kids, or the idea of being a kid, it's like representing that in some way. Yep. And I do remember, and maybe this has to do with like some of the breaking conventions or doing something different, but I remember, and maybe this is the kinds of people I was hanging out with, but like around like middle school to high school ish and you know, Hot Topic was a big deal, and buying clothes there and that kind of thing. But like there was like resurgence almost in like a Nightmare Before Christmas, where you know, people are buying merchandise. There's Cheshire Cat things, the kind of checkered patterns and that kind of thing. And I wonder like what it was that was like teenagers were engaging with it. And maybe that's some of that counterculture stuff that we were talking about from like the 60s coming in.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I wonder if it has to do with like story convention, like breaking conventions and doing things differently and kind of, you know, not being told what you can and can't do.
Yeah, I mean, whether or not, I mean, I think it has a bit of the allure of drug culture to it, but I think that at its heart, it's about like imagination and just kind of being free and like exploring the wonder of childhood before, you know, you lose your innocence as an adult. And I think there's a definitely like an appeal to that exists to this day. And, you know, there's a reason it's still really popular. It's still a book that people read. It's still, you know, people engage with these adaptations. I found a quote from Virginia Woolf that I thought was pretty apt. And she says, quote, "They are the only books in which we become children." I think that's right, because that's how it feels to read this. It puts you back in that headspace. And Lewis Carroll really captured that in a fascinating way. Philip Pullman cites this as like a prime influence. So, you know, a lot of modern authors look at this and, you know, again, been referenced a billion times.
So with all that being said, we've read quite a few children's novels on this podcast at this point. Did you engage with this like you would engage with any of the other ones? Or did you feel like, cause I feel like there's something here for people who are adults as well, like that. And we often say that as like the kids can enjoy it and the parents too. There's a lot of children's books written with that goal in mind, but here it's something about like digging into subtext and digging into, like you said, what it's like to be a child and remembering childhood. Mm-hmm. And I almost feel like I was engaging with it in that way. Did you think that as well?
Definitely, man. It maybe more than any of the other books we've read. I don't necessarily have as much affection for this as other children's books that I actually grew up with, but I could see so much of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. I think you can draw a direct line between this and that. And reading Pinocchio, it showed me one of the things I didn't love about Pinocchio, and we talked about, was how didactic it was and how it was like teaching the children a lesson. And this is a famous example, and it's funny because this was actually written before, as far as I know. This is a famous example of children's literature moving away from that kind of storytelling, because for the longest time, that's what it was. It was like, we're going to teach lessons to children. And if you think about this book, like, there's not a lot of lessons being taught here, other than maybe sort of subtextual ones. but it's a lot of like Alice being sort of rebellious and not necessarily, you know, following what adults would tell her to do. And in fact, there are few adults present, you know, if you want to even classify some of these characters she encounters. And she's often, you know, rebelling against the rules, not doing what people tell her to do, which in the Victorian era, the idea of a small child saying like, no, I'm going to do this other thing, like, That was transgressive in a sense.
That was something that I was picking up on too, is like, this is a strong-willed young woman.
I heard her called the first female lead of a children's book. Like probably the most iconic version, at least. Someone said it was the first. I don't know. I'm not like a historian on this stuff, so I'm taking their word for it. But definitely like the most iconic I can think of.
Yeah, and it did feel like it's that growth that children go through, right? Of eventually challenging people who are seemingly older than her. I would assume a lot of the characters she runs into are older than her, and like questioning belief systems and what people are telling you to do. So it's kind of an interesting, while not pounding you over the head with it, I think there's an interesting growth that happens throughout the course of the story. And then we get to the end, and it's like, I think both of the stories together, really, because it's funny, we're really talking about two different books here, but smashing them together, we get the full arc of what I think Alice goes through.
Well, if you're ready, man, I think we got a lot to talk about with Lewis Carroll here and the story of this man. He was born to a clergyman in 1832. He was the eldest son of 11 children, mostly sisters. His parents were first cousins, and he became sort of the leader of this pack of children. And he would go around telling them stories, drawing things for them. And some of the stories that eventually would make it into Alice's Adventures in Wonderland may have had their origins even in these early tales that he told as a child. There's some evidence for that. Part of this is just, it's so long ago that a lot of it is like, there's historians, there's all this stuff in museums and like finding little snippets. He took extensive journals. He wrote a lot of letters, so it's like piecing together things and trying to read between the lines, people who knew him and what they said. As a young man, he showed this like huge affinity for math, but he also had a severe speech impediment, spoke with a stutter. And because of that, he was often bullied and picked on by you know, other people, other kids. You know, you can kind of imagine what kind of man this would grow into be. Like, very nerdy, super into math, super into linguistics, but like can't speak clearly. So he was very into writing because of that. And in fact, he ended up adopting this pen name partially due to this, because his real name was Charles Lutwidge Dodson. And Dodson in particular was a difficult word for him to say. And in fact, there is a dodo bird in the book that is supposedly a representation of himself, because that was a nickname that people gave him, was Dodo, because he would struggle to say his last name, Dodson. So he kind of adopted that, the persona of the Dodo in the story itself. He also like was playing a linguistic game. So like he translated his name, if I remember how it was described, it was like he translated his name, Charles Ludwidge, into Latin, and then reversed the order and then translated it back into English. And apparently you get Lewis Carroll from that somehow. Wow. So it's like a little linguistic game to get to the pen name that he used. But he was very against like any fame and notoriety, at least. He did not want any notoriety for this. So as a young man, he starts working. So he goes to school at Oxford. While there, I think it was when he came back to work there. In the mid-1850s, he meets a man named Henry Liddell, who is the dean at Christ Church at Oxford. So I'm not sure like exactly how that works with Oxford, if there's multiple campuses or what, but this is the Christ Church, I guess, campus of Oxford. And apparently this is where the like famous like dining room that we see in like Harry Potter is from, this location. So this is where he's going, right, in this era. And he meets the dean, befriends him. And the dean has three young daughters. Their names were Lorena, Edith, and Alice. So Alice, obviously the most famous now, she becomes the figure that Alice from Alice in Wonderland was inspired by, as far as we know. Lewis Carroll, befriends these three children, and he starts like spending lots of time with them. He apparently like always felt more at home around children. He would write them letters where he would like, you know, he would like write in cubes, and he would like play little games, and he would do all this stuff. And they, you know, they found this quite entertaining. Apparently he like really came alive around children and seemed like almost a different person.
I'm going to just cut in here and say that that's either, you know, a very sweet thing or a very big red flag. So yeah. I know that I will admit I've heard that there's some controversial stuff about this figure. So I don't know what it is.
So I'm just going to present some of the facts. I'm not going to get into all of them. I think you are dead on, and like there is potentially big red flags, potentially that could be sweet, especially for the time. A lot of it is worth considering is the time, but I tend to agree with you, but I'm going to like try not to like come down too firmly on either side, because it is still a very divisive topic among fans and scholars as to like what actually was going on. And ultimately, it's hard to know like what was actually going on in the man's head. So you're going based off of evidence for something that happened like a really, really long time ago. And so there's very little remaining accounts. At the very least, it seems largely innocent for a while. He is very he becomes very friendly with them. He would like spend a lot of time with them, playing with them out in the like garden area at Oxford. He is quite taken with Alice because he is a photographer, I forgot to say. And this is a very new technology, right?
Oh yeah.
And he's one of the like early pioneers of this. In fact, like he has famous portraits of like a lot of influential figures at the time and artists at the time. He would actually like do these, you know, photographs of them and have them come sit. So he's actually like not just like hobbyist, like he's really into photography. And he is taking pictures of these children. And he finds that Alice is like a particularly striking child, and she takes like these really interesting photographs. And like I've seen a lot of them, they are really striking, right? So he's hanging out with them a ton, taking pictures of them, all this stuff. One famous day on July 4th of 1862, he goes on a boat ride. He's with the three children, the three littles, and his friend Duckworth. This is another academic at Oxford. And so he's on this boat ride. They're going down the River Isis. And as they're going, Alice wants him to tell them a story. And he's resisting, but she's insistent. And apparently she just really loves stories, really loved it when he would tell stories. And finally he agrees. He says, all right, I'll tell you a story. Apparently it was a really hot day. And so they spend some time rowing, and then they go off to the bank, and they all like seek shade under a tree. And they're sitting there together. And he's telling this story. And apparently it was a mixture of him just kind of off the cuff riffing, just like, you know, this happens and this happens and this happens. And he basically says like, you know, I'm going to tell you the story of Alice and her journey to Wonderland. Right. So he's put her into the story as the main character, essentially. And there's a lot of these little references to like the things that they're seeing. Like there's this treacle well, it's this like famous little like thing near the river. And that shows up in the book. There's a duck and there's a dodo, and those are supposed to be like Duckworth and him, right? And then there are three girls who are these three sisters who are playing in the treacle well, and that's like a reference to the three sisters. So he's giving all these little references, and then he's also sort of telling this story to them, but he's also entertaining his friend, who's a contemporary, and so he's also making a lot of references to like famous theologians and mathematicians and like people like that, and like maybe this one character is kind of based off of this like one professor they knew, and like so there's a lot of little in jokes in there as well that maybe were there to entertain this other adult who was present. And so he tells this story, supposedly a magical day. He has this written about in his diary, and he marks in his diary like whenever there's a really notable day, he puts like a stone, like white stone day or something. I forget if he like actually marked it with a stone or like what. After this, Alice is like, you need to write this down. She tells him, will you please write this down? So he spends the next year writing all these stories down, and he composes what is called Alice's Adventures Underground. And he writes her a book and gives it to her on, I think on Christmas or on her birthday, as a gift. And this written edition includes a bunch of his own illustrations, and is perfect. There's not a single like typographical error. There's no smudging. It is perfectly hand composed, and it's like perfect in every way, right? Like it is pristine. Gives it to her, and in fact, he has a photograph of her that was like included at the end in a little circle. But if they later lifted it up and found out that he had actually drawn a portrait of her, and he had covered it with the photo, so that's in there. A lot of these cool little details. By the way, I'm gonna go ahead and shout this out. I watched this hour-long documentary that I'm going to put in the show notes that absolutely think is worth watching if people like want to know more about this. It was called The Secret World of Lewis Carroll, aka the controversial genius behind Alice in Wonderland. I'll put a link to the video in the show notes. It's really good, and it goes over a lot of this stuff. But I also watched a few other videos and sort of condensing a lot of the things I saw and read about this. So his friends find out about it, people that knew him. They're like, this is actually really good. This is a really cool, like, little adventure you wrote. You should try and publish this. And apparently he knows, I forget his first name, but one of the Macmillans, like, of Macmillan publishers.
Publishing, yeah.
Yeah. He, like, knows them back in the day, right? And so he had these connections, right? So he's like, all right, I'll explore it. And he ends up approaching them about it. And sure enough, they want to publish it. But they say, maybe you should get a professional illustrator. Now, I've seen the illustrations he did, and they're actually quite good, but you know, they're not, you know, they're not necessarily like a professional quality. So he ends up working with this famous artist who was already famous at the time, John Tenniel, and he would produce these black and white illustrations that remain to this day sort of the definitive depictions of this story, because he worked with Lewis Carroll to develop them. They had a lot of notes going back and forth. Apparently Lewis Carroll had like tons of edits that he would keep sending back, like, change this, change this, change this. So they ultimately ended up at something that Lewis Carroll approved. And so, like, this is the approved, like, art of this, right? Other than maybe the ones that he did himself, which, by the way, that edition exists in a museum. The original one that he gave to Alice, it is a physical, you know, thing that you can go see. And it's pretty incredible. So that becomes the first edition, which is released, 1865, as we discussed. So it is super popular, but of course the sequel, we see this with a lot of books where, like, the sequel become like sells even more, or even more immediately. And that's, I think it's sometimes it's like a lagging indication of the popularity of the original, but Through the Looking Glass comes out in 1871. And that explodes in popularity and is actually even more popular than the first book. And yeah, I mean, the legacy of him is born here. I will touch on some of the controversy now. So you can already see that, like, yeah, this guy's hanging out with children a lot. He seems to like being around them a lot. Seemed particularly friendly with these three littles. So somewhere in between 1863 and 1865, maybe, I think it might have just been the year 1863, his journals, his diary, they have all of these, right? But there's like a year where all of the pages have been removed. And it's theorized that his nieces later on, when they got a hold of them, removed them. They never said why. There were some implications about maybe why. During that time, he was dismissed from Oxford for a period of about a year before he was allowed to return. And there's a stark difference in his relationship with the children beforehand and afterwards. Like, after he comes back, like, he remains aloof and he doesn't interact with them much. And it seems like likely the implication is something happened between the littles and him, and, you know, being the dean of the college basically got him kicked out for at least a little while. It is unclear what it was. There is lots of theories. Theory number one, obviously, with Alice herself, too affectionate, maybe taking certain pictures that the parents didn't like, that could have been the reason. There's also heavy implications that the elder sister is actually maybe the potential target of these affections or inappropriate actions with. She was, at the time that this occurred, around 13, which apparently was the age of consent was 12 in this era, in Victorian era. In theory, him maybe showing affections to her wasn't actually, like, illegal at the time and wouldn't have been completely against the rules or the law, I guess. Even as, again, today we look at this very differently, right? So keep in mind today versus Victorian era. And then there's also some implication that he might have been interested in the sisters. They had a governess, and perhaps he had been showing some unwanted attraction to her, and that was actually what caused the stir. And she would have been older, so maybe around his age, I don't know. Also, there's an implication that the Liddell's mother really wanted her daughters to end up marrying, like, dukes, like royalty, like really wealthy people, right? And there's some implication that she was actually the one who was most, like, upset about whatever this was. And there's stories. So that documentary I watched was like literally interviewing the like great, great granddaughter of Alice, like Alice Little. And she's like, in our family, there's been stories passed along about how, you know, their great grandmother or whatever, however many greats it was, like burned all these letters from Lewis Carroll and like didn't want him to correspond with the family anymore for whatever reason. So after that, he does. He keeps his distance from them and they kind of go their separate ways. As he becomes more and more popular, he starts forming friendships with other children. And in fact, it was said that he had hundreds of friendships with young children, you know, as an author going forward. Usually they're, you know, from what I understand, their parents were present or they had like somebody with them. It wasn't like he was hanging out with them by themselves, but he had these friendships with them and he would often photograph them. Some of those photographs exist to this day and some of them are nudes. Today, really bad. Can't do that. In the Victorian era, many contemporary photographers were doing exactly this. It actually was not an uncommon thing. There are many famous examples of people who would photograph nude children. They thought it was like a, you know, an expression of like the beauty of innocence and like all this stuff. It wasn't the same way we look at it now, right? Maybe it was due to a lack of awareness, or maybe it was due to just like it being a more innocent time. Hard to say, right? Like we're all just kind of peering back through the fog of time and trying to figure out what things were like. During this documentary, like towards the end of it, somebody reaches out to them or something. I forget exactly how it comes out, but there's this like photo that they find in a museum in like France or something. And it's supposedly, it's like a full frontal nude of this young girl who bears a striking resemblance to the eldest sister of the Liddell's family. And she would have been probably about 13 at the time. And they do this like forensic analysis of it. They bring it to an expert to like see if it's authentic. And it was authentically taken around that time with the technology, like developed with the technology that Lewis Carroll would have had and taken with a camera similar to or like he had. It was attributed, like it's written on the back of it somewhere that this is Lewis Carroll photographing and then her name. And then there's like a dealer's name or something underneath it, which they don't know who this was. And then they had a forensic analyst come in who like does court forensics on like comparing different photographs of people to determine if they're the same person. And he said that if he was in court, he would say he had a moderate level of accuracy or moderate level of confidence that it's the same person. But since he's not in court, he said that like his belief was it's the same person. So the belief is this is a photo probably taken by Lewis Carroll of the eldest of the Liddells. And at the time, she would have been, yeah, like 13 or something. So this seems to be a lot of, you know, maybe if there's a lot of smoke here, maybe there's some fire to this. All that being said, there are a lot of scholars who are very adamantly in the camp of this is not true and that this is a modern perception of this man's, you know, he was clearly like obsessed with children, but not in the way that we tend to think of it.
I would say,
go ahead.
All those variables. To me, like you said, where there's smoke, there's fire. I don't, you know, claim to be a historian. I don't know all the details. I just know that someone who is that fascinated with children, and there's a scandal of him being removed from Oxford for a period of time. And
the scandal is shrouded in so much mystery, man. Like, what actually was it?
You can say what you will about photographing at the time, but I can't imagine that there's not some level of fascination that goes beyond the artistic there, which is scary because, you know, seemingly successful, well-connected person, power dynamics, age of consent being 12, 13, like that doesn't matter because not everyone was pursuing women that were 12 to 13. It's kind of, I don't know, that's pretty damning stuff that you've just presented to me, in my opinion.
I think so too. Ultimately, I come down on like, I think there was probably something going on here. Again, you never know unless you're actually like, we could get in the guy's head, like what actually was going on. And there's not a lot of like direct evidence. And in fact, that photo, like some to this day still dispute whether or not it was actually taken by him. And you know, again, it seemed like they did a pretty good job of like confirming that it probably was, but there's no actual proof that it was, right? Regardless, it is just interesting, right? Like they had a bunch of these different scholars on and they were like adamant, you know, like different ones are like, it's too like juicy a story to where like people love it and they love the idea of him being, it's like, oh, that favorite book you have was actually written by this guy who had, you know, these proclivities. And then other people are like, no, it's actually just that a lot of people have a beloved figure that they don't want to believe something bad about, and they want to believe is being miscast by history. As far as I know, there hasn't been any more like damning evidence to come out. So from everything I saw, it's like still pretty divided. I tend to agree with you, James. It looks to me like something was probably going on. At what point in his life? Was it always happening? Was it something to develop later? Who knows? We're not in his mind. And how does that affect the way we view his work? That's an open question. I think it's going to be something that everybody has to decide for themselves. I am going to try and separate it as much as I can. I think the influence and the brilliance, honestly, of this work is still sort of indisputable. And so, you know, all we can really do is go forward looking at it that way. And again, I think there is enough doubt there to where, like, I'm not ready to completely say one way or another.
Like I said, man, that dynamic, though, of being like, you know, are people leaving their children with this guy because he's such a friendly person, and how that can sort of evolve? And is he taking nude photos possibly without consent from anyone involved?
That's the potential, right? Like, because if that's going on, it's fucking awful.
Yeah.
But then there's also the potential that it's actually not really that, and it's kind of grown into that because that's such a salacious story to tell, right?
Yeah. I tend to err on the side of, like, if her and
I think
family...
that's because we're both kind of cynical. Maybe it's like how cynical or optimistic you are about humanity. I'm kind of cynical about humanity.
If the stories are to be believed of like she and the family and these stories passed down the Liddell family, I tend to believe them.
What's funny, though, concerned. Is the Liddell family actually seem a lot more fond of Lewis Carroll than that would lead you to believe. And in fact, like the great great granddaughter was like, I don't know, kind of very forgiving of, or like the sort of the way that this relationship has been cast over time, and much more is it being more of an innocent friendship. But it, granting that some things aren't known anyway, it's messy. Even it's funny because even these like 80-year-olds, it was clear that they didn't like talking about it, and they didn't want it to be like known about, as people were sort of poking into it. It's weird, but anyway, let's move on. We spent a lot of time on it. It's a big controversy, but
good context to have, right? Going into the story, it'd be irresponsible to not have any of the details. And I think, you know, as generations go on, they're probably removed from the trauma, possible trauma, enough to say, like, look at the legacy of this story and kind of want to connect their family to it in ways. I'm still very much in the camp of, like, I'm not a huge fan of all the information I've heard.
So one other detail, it seemed like Alice was actually quite fond of her notoriety from this. And in fact, she would go on to marry a man named Hargraves, and their first son she named Carroll, which some people have taken to be like homage to Lewis Carroll. But she claimed that it had no connection to that, supposedly. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, so let's talk about some things that actually happened in these books, scenes that stood out to you. What did you find of particular interest? Let's start with Alice's adventures in Wonderland.
Yeah, I mean, so Alice going down the rabbit hole just from the get-go is this portal fantasy, right? Like, you're going to seemingly another world, a Narnia, you know, Wizard of Oz kind of scenario, which this obviously came before all of that. And I love the idea
classic
of going on this
example
adventure.
Of a portal fantasy for sure.
And then eventually getting to like this the change in the body. I would assume that this is a big factor in talking about like childhood and like confusion and growing up and not being in control. Like drinking these different things and eating these different things. People are telling her to do these things.
Yeah. It was funny how she was just walking around just eating random shit, drinking random shit. Like,
which again, if you want to talk about the drug context of it, is like just try everything and experiment, see what happens. And, you know,
definitely kind of like engaging with life to the fullest. Right. And like not living with fear. It seems like Alice is honestly pretty fearless throughout. She doesn't seem particularly like put off by any of these bizarre things she's meeting. Even the Cheshire cat, who's quite creepy.
Yeah.
Right. Like the smile appears before the cat, and it's like clearly kind of like this magical entity. And like, she doesn't seem afraid of anything really. She just kind of takes it all in stride and is, you know, having a good time. If anything, she gets a little bit annoyed at times or like bored. She's like, you've told me like too long of a poem now or something.
I didn't remember a lot of these characters being such dicks to Alice too. Like, everyone's pretty rude off the bat.
Seemed
like, and like interesting because I think in most kids' stories, fantastical entities tend to, you know, some of them are evil, but they tend to be like whimsical and happy to, and all this, and there's just people who are like depressed and mad, yeah. and like there's all this different stuff going on that I think is, again, engaging for a child, because I felt like that was a fresh thing when I was engaging with the story growing up.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different things that get touched on. Like, language is such an essential part of this book, as we're dealing with like wordplay and we're dealing with puns. Like, there's all these like puns that get made.
Yeah, I found myself engaging a lot with these games. A lot of like you said, puns, wordplay. That shows a lot of effort by an artist, right? Like, that's someone who's like, you can write a poem, but then he's like writing poems backwards in some mm-hmm. cases. And like that is such a, like, that's clearly someone who loves language, and reminds me of like a Tolkien, who we've talked about quite a bit, how he like created languages and things like that. But mm-hmm. I think this is someone that you can see as an artist like that wanted to create an interesting world. And it seems like you said, he created an entire genre possibly.
There's so many cool examples of this, like The Mouse's Tale. Now, I listened to the audiobook, so I didn't see this, but then I saw it later and I was like, oh, okay, this would have been cool to see. So apparently, it's an example of what's called concrete poetry, and it like looks like a mouse's tail, and it's like written and it like squiggles down the page. Mm-hmm. And like, it was originally printed that way in 1865. And like, that was groundbreaking to like see something like that in a book. And the illustrations, by the way, were also like included, where like the text would like move to the side and there'd be an illustration alongside the text. That was also new. Usually illustrations had their own dedicated page, right? Like, they didn't appear beside the text. He was also like famous for like how many like conversations were going on and things like that. Like, that was unusual for writing at the time. It was a lot of like long descriptions, like, you know, different kinds of writing. And I think he identified what was interesting to children was conversations and illustrations. And so that's a ton of this is those two things together,
especially with talking animals, right?
Totally. And then think about like the mathematics that we even get in here. Like, when she's first falling down the rabbit hole, she's like calculating her distance to the center of the earth and is like talking about, well, I'm gonna appear on the other side where everybody's upside down and like all this stuff. And like, I don't know, it you can even start to see like the math coming into play. You know, she gets quizzed on arithmetic. She's like, 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 + 1. And, you know, she like loses track. She's like, oh, she doesn't know addition. And so there's all these like math games going on. And then logic, like so many weird logical games with like word games and stuff being thrown at her, riddles. It's just full of this stuff. And it's like, even as it's kind of nonsensical, there's all these little games going on that keeps it engaging, again, to an adult reader like me.
And I mentioned before, like, everybody being mean to her, there comes a point where she starts kind of pushing back and saying like, you can't treat me that way. And like, there's quite a few moments where like she embodies that, like when the queen is saying like, off with your heads, they're basically like killing off all these, which what an iconic, like, cool thing to think of, like a deck of cards as the soldiers and the queen of hearts and the king of hearts, and the way that he's playing with games within his world, like he's taking those games in. And again, things that everyone's familiar with, universal things, everybody's seen a deck of cards and knows. So anyway, queen of hearts is being quite the tyrant, and then she eventually like starts growing and physically becomes able to stand up for herself, as well as she is like telling them like, fuck you. You're not going to behead me and all these people or whatever.
It all seemed like a commentary on, you know, royalty, right? And potentially on the, you know, the royalty within England. And apparently, like, there was some reference maybe people have read in, like, when she first encounters the cards, they're painting these white roses red because they were, you know, supposed to be red, but instead they accidentally grew white ones. But that was, like, the symbol for the other opposing queen. And this is like a reference to the War of the Roses, where like there was the red roses and the white roses, apparently. So there's all these like little references again to like real things. But then, yeah, the idea of this queen is just like, honestly, genuinely funny. The way she's like ordering everybody off with his head, and like she's like, she has a solution, you know, and like everyone's terrified to be around her because they're like, she's going to order them to their death. Like, I don't know, a lot of that stuff was genuinely funny, and it definitely was like poking fun at the aristocracy. And I do agree, like, I like how Alice outgrows it and says, you're just a deck of cards, and she sort of like her own power becomes asserted at the end, and she is not ultimately threatened by it. Yeah, really fascinating stuff, like social commentary. One interesting note is that the tea party, like a very famous tea party, right? Which is full of all these little logical games where it's like time has been stopped, and so it's always tea time. And then they're like changing places to try different like pieces of the meal out. And there's this like slumbering, what was it, the mouse?
Mouse. Dormouse.
Just, like, keeps the dormouse keeps waking up to talk, and like, it was really funny. And you know, they pose a riddle that they don't end up answering. It's like, what's the difference between a raven and a writing desk or something like that? And then she's like, is it this? And she's like, he's like, I don't know what it is. That's why I asked. So it's like, again, that like nonsense of like, we're posing these little games that they have no answer. And then at one point she just gets annoyed with him and she just walks away from it. She's like, I'm done. And she leaves. And that's the end of that. But one interesting note is that that wasn't in the original Alice's Adventures Underground. That was added for the like published edition.
Entire Tea Party?
The entire Tea Party, yeah.
Oh, wow.
But apparently that was also commentary potentially on like Alice actually would have actual tea parties for her birthday. Mm. And so he was maybe writing about that.
We also have to talk a lot about the other story, which is Through the Looking Glass, which the basis of this story is she goes through a mirror back into Wonderland, and it's the sequel story. And very quickly meets the Red Queen, I believe, right? And she's saying like, I'm going to make you a queen if you can basically like get to the eighth space. And in terms of spaces, it's a chessboard. So it's kind of cool, again, to bring another game in and have kind of her story progress as she's a pawn moving her way to possibly becoming a queen. A lot of other hijinks happens. We hear a lot of the stuff about the nursery rhymes. We have the Humpty Dumpty stuff, the Tweedledee and Tweedledum.
Jabberwocky. She encounters the Jabberwocky and she reads it and she's like, what does this mean? And she goes and she asks Humpty Dumpty, who like gives her some explanations for it. And then apparently like Lewis Carroll has provided some explanations about how he like arrived at creating these words. So I think importantly, she's playing with these kittens at the start of the book, and one of them like transforms, or she calls the Red Queen, and then maybe is the Red Queen. And then at the end of the book, she's like shaking the Red Queen and it turns back into the kitten. And then there's also this Red King who was discovered at one point sleeping. And, I think it's Tweedledee and Tweedledum says that he is dreaming of Alice and that's like why she exists.
Yeah.
So they don't want to wake him up. And so that's like pretty trippy. And then at the end of the book, she returns to that and she's like, did I dream of him or did he dream of me? And so there's a lot of like philosophy going on in here too about like what it means to be alive and like what is, because like she's also constantly questioning who she even is throughout both of these books. She's like, I woke up feeling kind of different today. Maybe I'm a different person. Like, who am I really? So there's a lot of like questions about what even it means to have a self and to have a personhood. And a lot of this stuff is like engaged with, it's a big topic, so it's engaged with in a way that children, I think, can still enjoy it. So really cool. And then, yeah, I love that too. And to me, that implies that the Red King maybe is the author in some sense too, of like imagining the character.
Yeah.
Perhaps. So there's all these different kind of things you can read into this. And yeah, I love this idea of like going through the looking glass and like basically everything's in reverse once she goes through.
Yeah.
So like time progresses differently. And in fact, I read that the idea of this messenger who is in prison already, and it's like his trial isn't even until next week, and he won't commit the crime for another like month or something, right?
Yeah.
And that this may have been an influence on Philip K. Dick with Minority Report and the idea of pre-crime and like,
yeah, I can see that.
You know, all this stuff. Apparently, like this is, you know, and apparently something happens in 1984 as well, which actually I haven't read. Hopefully, we can get to it one day. But there's some idea about like locking people up for crimes they have yet to commit, and that some of that maybe owes to this. I don't know if either of them have confirmed that that's where it came from. But
it's definitely a big head trip for a kid too, right? At the end, when you're like, that's such a crazy reveal, because she's in the final conflict with the Red Queen, because the Red Queen is like refusing to make her a queen either or whatever, because she's already done everything that she said that
she would
do.
But she's not like officially a queen yet until she passes some sort of test.
And then so she's kind of throttling her at one point and shaking her, and then that like dissolves back into the real world. And like you said, that feels so dreamlike, and then that would explain a lot of the adventures we've seen if someone else was dreaming of Alice, if Alice was just a dream all along.
Well, and that goes
in that
back
way,
to
that
the
meta
to the
commentary
book.
Of that's what I mean, yeah, of both books, yeah.
Yeah, because in the first book, it ends similarly with her. She like rejects the cards and they're all like swarming her and they're going to jump on her. And she's going to, you know, seems like she's getting attacked by the cards. And she wakes up like in her sister's lap. And her sister's like, you've been having this dream. and they like discuss it, and then Alice like goes off, and the sister then has a dream in which all of these same figures appear. So the sister is like living her sister's dream. Really interesting implications of that too, and like the nature of storytelling, and like how it's kind of a shared dream that you can put out into the world. How many people have now had this shared dream? Was it originally Lewis Carroll's dream? I don't know. Or you know, and obviously inspired by a real person named Alice. So it's really fascinating. And it's one of those that, like, he's really known for these two books. And yes, some of the poetry therein and stuff like that. But, like, what a powerful thing to create, and how just, like, influential it has been is really, like, hard to quantify. It's one of the most influential pieces we've ever talked about, I think.
It's so abstract. It's a kid's story, and it's this abstract story in a time when everything was kind of rigid, and these are the rules of storytelling.
Yeah.
So yeah, I feel the impact, and like the story still holds water. Like I really enjoyed going through it.
So many quotable lines, man. Some of the most quotable lines.
Yeah, there were so many moments. Like the moment when Cheshire Cat says like we're all mad here. I was like, oh yeah, such a like those there's those moments that you know those lines. Yeah. And they have that impact, and they're so iconic.
So yeah, this part here I thought was you know, quite iconic. So Alice laughed. "There's no use trying," she said. "One can't believe impossible things." "I dare say you haven't had much practice," said the Queen. "When I was your age, I always did that for half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast." I didn't even realize believing, you know, these things before breakfast. Like, does that occur in like? I feel like Wonka references this at some point, right? In his like speech to the children about things being impossible. Like it's like, I feel like it's just everywhere, and I just haven't even realized it.
That whimsy definitely like kind of almost just continues on into a lot of these like weirder projects. And
I definitely can see some Alice in Wonderland with going into Wonka's factory, right? Like I feel like there's references in there if we were to go back and watch it. Like I bet you there's a lot of that.
Yeah. And I love a story that like champions imagination, right? Like I know so many do. But like this is kind of such an early iteration possibly, and like we've talked about the influence, something that just lets kids know that they can be weird and different. I've always found to be, I don't know, really rewarding kind of morality lessons for kids early on.
I love that it's like free in that way. It's not trying to lecture, and it empowers Alice here. Like she's sort of above it all. She's like takes everything in stride. She's cool, right? Like Alice is just a cool protagonist. So I can see why people love her and like dress up at her, you know, as her to this day.
Yeah. Did you ever play that like sort of like gothic Alice video game?
No, I didn't. I know about it though. And I was going to say, like, as we're starting to move into adaptation territory, like there's been so many. I was reading like over 40 film adaptations in 12 different languages, animated, stop motion. There's video games. There are operas. There are ballets. It's just been adapted in so many different ways, so many different times. And then, yeah, like I know for a fact there's like a horror video game that's all about Alice, right? I don't know if you found it.
Yeah, came out. I just had to look it up. It's called Alice. The one I played was called Alice Madness Returns. I think it might be a sequel. Mm-hmm. Came out in 2011, and that game was pretty badass. Like she has a knife and she's going around like all these iconic areas that they talk about, like the garden. You just get to go, and she's kind of like getting back at all these characters and kind of taking control. So it's like, I don't know, continuation, an alternate version. It's very cool.
I think that's where we should leave the books for now. We will be tackling the Disney adaptation because, as I repeatedly saw, it is the most famous version of this. But if there are other alternate versions of Alice in Wonderland that you would like to hear us cover, definitely let us know those eventually. But that's what we'll be returning with next week. If you enjoyed our coverage of the books, let us know in the form of a rating and review on whatever app you chose to listen on. And if you're on YouTube, make sure to leave a comment and let us know your thoughts on a lot of these topics and whether or not you read this as a child and what's its legacy like. Would you read it to a child today? I'd love to hear that kind of stuff on YouTube. And make sure to like and subscribe to our channel, please.
And be sure to connect with us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of those at Ink2Film. We're also on Blue Sky, TikTok, so just keep an eye out. We're everywhere.
We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/Ink2Film, where we release bonus episodes every month. If you can afford to do it, we would love to have a little bit of support from you. For as little as $2, you can get all this bonus content. We're going to be putting one out soon, reacting to the first season of The Fallout Show on Amazon Prime. So if you're curious about our thoughts about that, definitely check that out. I love Fallout. It's like one of my like oldest fandoms in video games. So I'm excited to talk about that one.
Yeah, I can't wait. Speaking of video game, we were just talking about the Alice one too. Supporting us on Patreon also helps the show continue in its current form. So we appreciate that. Thank you to Ross Bugden for the use of our intro and outro music as well. All right, well, that's where we're going to leave the book here. We're going to watch that Disney film. I'm looking forward to it. But until then, I'm going to be listening to a lot of Jefferson Airplane. White Rabbit, man, it's so stuck in my head. I listened to it like 2 times, and it's just right, feed your head.
I'm going to have to go listen to it. I didn't. Honestly, I was trying not to engage with any of the adaptations yet. I was like, I'm going to wait, but I'm going to do that. I'm going to go engage with that. I want to listen to music. I want to, you know, maybe I'll seek out that video game. I'm really curious now to get into that. And that'll be what we talk about next week. So until next time,
keep adapting.